Thanks so much for having me. I'm Lisa, as Derek had mentioned, and also my co-author, Corey Davis, is here, and he's a lawyer with the Network for Public Health Law. And we're happy today to be talking to you about this this incongruence between our emphasis on evidence-based practice and evidence-free policy. So what do we do about this tension that currently exists? In this presentation today, I'll be talking to you about evidence-based practice, the difference between evidence-free policy, or how we have morality policy come up with our public policy solutions for public and social health interventions. We'll talk about different case examples, how this has been exhibited, but focus particularly on sterile syringe access and focus on needle exchange programming, particularly in the U.S. And then I'll conclude by talking about our role as advocates and how we can bridge this emphasis on evidence-based practice into having more evidence-based policy instead of lack thereof. So this talk is really a nice blend between law, public policy, social work, and public health. And so hopefully with our interdisciplinary understanding of this, we'll come to better solutions for public and social health policy. We all know what evidence-based practice is and how it dictates so much of our professional discipline, using the professional expertise, using the evidence that's available, and then the client-centered needs in order to come up with a practice or intervention. This really helps get us away from our authority-based approach, why we do things because we're either the expert or it's because we've always done it that way. So we really rely on evidence to help guide our intervention. But as we know, there's benefits and challenges of using evidence-based practice, particularly in a time of fiscal austerity where we have too much need and too little resources. We know that we have to prove what we do is efficacious and that it works and that we do it with purpose. And so that is a great benefit of evidence-based practice. It helps us become more professionalized in our education and how we train young social workers, public health professionals. It helps us build consensus around policized issues, so we really know what the evidence is. It is something that guides our funding priorities and our research streams, but yet it also has some drawbacks, and I wanted to make sure we talked about some of those drawbacks with evidence-based practice alone. We know that it's very time-intensive. We know that methodologically, evidence-based practice is predicated on very rigorous methods in terms of randomized control trials, which not every practitioner or community group is able to actually implement, and so it's not necessarily the most user-friendly type of approach, and it really doesn't take into account community-based involvement. So if we're trying to impact the health and social conditions of communities, we need to make sure communities are stakeholders and on board. And that also speaks to the translation and implementation process. We can write about the findings from our randomized control trials in journals that are read by 6 or 12 or 18 of our colleagues, but is that really being translated to the community? And that has been something that researchers have not always done a really nice job on. So in a rational world, that this emphasis on evidence-based practice, which would really lend itself to adopting evidence-based policy. So if we're going to rationalize evidence, of course we would want our policy to be based on this evidence as well. That would draw itself from a careful collection of rigorous experimentation and mixed methodologies that would help us answer three questions. What exactly is the problem? What are the possible ways to address the problem? And what are the probable impacts and costs of each? So we know evidence cannot help solve every problem or fix every program. It can illuminate the path to a more effective public policy. And it sounds so rational and great, but that's unfortunately not what we see in our policy. And it creates this paradox of evidence emphasis, and yet the policy is not evidence-based. So when I talk about this paradox, there's several things that I mean. The first is that despite our emphasis on evidence-based practice, our yield in evidence-based policy is not consistent. There was an article by Shulock, and it was titled "The Paradox of Policy Analysis. If it's not used, why do we produce so much of it?" And I think that sums up the paradox pretty well. The second paradox is that we know where to produce evidence-based practice. We know what kind of methods to use. If we ourselves are not doing that intervention, we know how to read about it through systematic reviews or meta-analysis. So we know where to find the evidence, and yet that's not translating into our policy. In fact, if you go through the public policy literature, it says that that information is more strategic rather than substantive. So our policymakers are not using the substance of that evidence, they're using the politics of that evidence to help shape public policy. And that is clearly, that's clearly a problem. And that is going to have a major impact on our public and social health policies. We know that the path from research to policy is long and winding because of election cycles and people having to do things that is going to appeal to their constituents. They may not want to adopt something because it is too controversial. And we know that evidence-based policy is an accumulative process. We know that evidence doesn't just come packaged to you neatly and nicely in a box and you get to make beautiful policy out of it. It happens continually and over time. And because that evidence is constantly being produced, we don't have a very clear, neat policy that comes out of it. So what ends up happening is we end up playing politics instead of looking at evidence policy. And so when I had talked earlier about those questions in terms of what exactly the problem is, what are the possible ways to address that problem, and what are the probable impacts of each, there's a fourth question we need to ask, and that's what political and social values do the proposed options reflect. And this is inherent in every policy, but we don't explicitly talk about it. And if you wanted to learn more about this, you can read Schneider and Ingram's foundational article that talks about the social constructions of target populations, how people can be perceived positively or negatively, and how their political strength, as positive or negative, is going to impact the policies that they are going to be impacted by. So you could have a policy that's going to help you with some sort of benefit, or you could have a policy that's going to provide some sanction or burden on you. And depending on where you fit in their categorization, you could be considered an advantage policy recipient, you could be a dependent policy recipient, or you could be a deviant policy recipient. And in the case of injection drug users, as I will explain, they would be considered deviant policy recipients because they have burdens. They don't have policies that are based on evidence. So instead of evidence-based policy, we tend to have policies for deviant categories, as Schneider and Ingram would call them, that are evidence-free, that are more based on these other factors instead of the evidence that's available. So things like morality politics, which throughout time, from prohibition all the way to a current context, these are the kind of policies that help to they try to regulate personal and moral behavior about what is right and what is wrong, what is sinful, what is not, who is deserving, who is not. Authority policy, what the experts tell us to do. And then ideology, and the ideologies that I'm talking about are those fundamental American exceptionalism type of ideologies, the belief in the individual, the belief in individual responsibility, the belief in laissez-faire economics. These are the types of ideologies that shape our public policy. And then financial interests. Who are the PACs behind, who are the lobbyists behind certain policies? Who are the interest groups that are kind of being overshined in comparison to the vulnerable groups that need policy that are going to protect them? So this is really important because, unfortunately, evidence-free policy is really impacting the most vulnerable populations, those populations that fall into those dependent and deviant categories, and that's where we have evidence. So as I had mentioned, I would talk a little bit about cases where we've seen this conflict, this political conflict between morality politics and evidence in policy. We can see this from prohibition to our treatment of people who use drugs through the war on drugs, for example, sex work, sexual risk behaviors, comprehensive sex education, reproductive access, and then, as I had mentioned, sterile syringe access, particularly looking at needle exchange programs. And so before I go into that, I'll give us a little background about injection drug use and the need for sterile syringe access. We know that needle exchange programs are an effective public health approach to reducing the spread of HIV and AIDS and other blood-borne diseases, where an individual can bring a needle or a syringe and get an equal amount back. And usually needle exchange programming is coupled with voluntary counseling and testing, condom, a place to get clean cookers or waters, things that are going to help keep them safe. And injection drug use is still a main transmission route for blood-borne pathogens in the U.S. depending on where you are in the U.S., we're going to see different incidences. So whereas in the South, where I live in North Carolina, men who have sex with men is still the dominant cause of new transmission. But in places like Massachusetts and Puerto Rico, for example, injection drug use is the main source of infection. So location really matters. Injection drug use has directly and indirectly contributed to more than a third of new HIV infections since the beginning of the AIDS epidemic. And this is not necessarily through injection drug users alone, but also with people who have sex with injection drug users, their sexual partners and their children who can be impacted. So the role of needle exchange programming in protecting injection drug users was first came to light in the Netherlands in the 70s, right around the time that the kind of HIV/AIDS epidemic was exploding in the United States. And instead of responding in a similar way as we saw in the early 80s, our government responded with the war on drugs. And so we didn't have the same type of programs. We didn't want to invest in the same types of programming around needle exchange programming. So despite the evidence that this helped reduce HIV, that's not the policy direction that we took. Currently, there are just over 200 needle exchange programs in the U.S. operating in 33 states. But as I will mention, these programs have to be run by local philanthropy, local counties, which is becoming increasingly difficult given the fiscal constraints that many counties and states are experiencing currently. So despite a plethora of evidence that needle exchange programs work and that they're efficacious, this has been studied extensively in several randomized control trials and several of those methodological ways that demonstrate true science evidence. Despite major national organizational support for needle exchange programming as an effective HIV prevention strategy, this is not where our public policy has been driven. Major support from the Surgeon General, NASW, APHA, the Institute of Medicine, the National Commission on AIDS. I could keep listing organizations that have said this is an effective HIV intervention, and yet we don't have the same kind of policy to back that up. In fact, there's been a federal ban on federal dollars for needle exchange programming for 21 years. So from 1988 to 2009, no federal dollars could go to support a needle exchange program operating. Congress did vote to lift this ban, and this was a victory, but it was a symbolic victory because no additional monies were put aside for needle exchange programming. So this was great. It lasted 2 years, and then the ban got reinstated. So again, we're sort of back to square one where we were in the 80s, where we don't have federal dollars going to support this evidence-based intervention for HIV. So the funding and programs, as I had said, remain small and modest in scope. We really do see that needle exchange program is a perfect example of how morality politics has really won out the evidence-based policy that's needed for this type of intervention. Despite the ample evidence, and I really glossed over that, but despite the ample evidence that's there, despite the fact that this intervention is a really low complexity intervention, you do not need to have very fancy letters behind your name in order to do this intervention. You don't need to have a very specialized skill in order to exchange a needle with someone. You don't need to have very fancy or expensive equipment. So despite the evidence, despite low complexity, despite the cost benefit, the fact that it's about a dollar to give a clean needle versus the hundreds of thousands of dollars it takes to spend on treating hepatitis and other bloodborne pathogens, despite the ease of the intervention, you could do it day or night, any time of day, any place, and the fact that it's been proven globally effective, we don't have evidence-based policy around needle exchange programming. However, I don't want to depress you all and think that there's not lessons to be learned from looking at needle exchange programming as a policy example. There are several things that we need to think about as advocates that are working in the harm reduction world and also with trying to move towards more of an evidence-based policy approach. The first is that we need to take back that morality argument. For too often, we have relied on our evidence to support this wonderful intervention, and we've too often been shot down by the morality of people who oppose needle exchange programming, that it's wrong, that it sends a condoning message for people who use illegal drugs. And you know what? I'm morally outraged, too. I'm morally outraged at the conditions that contribute to people having HIV in this country. And so I, as proponent for needle exchange programming don't need to shun that morality. I can kind of own it and accept it. I can look at this not just as something that is condoning sinful behavior, but really it's part of my values and ethics as a social worker working towards social justice. We can also learn to reframe the issue. So instead of thinking about this as just something that impacts people who decide to use injection drugs, we can look at this as an issue that impacts their sexual partners, their community members, their children. And we can also look at this as a fiscally responsible approach, especially when counties and states and the federal government has less money to spend on HIV prevention. This is a fiscally conservative way to use our resources. We also need to think about unlikely partners that can work with us on this type of approach for needle exchange programming. One of the ways that we can do this was something that Corey Davis spoke about earlier on in the conference, but that's looking at law enforcement. So whereas before, law enforcement and needle exchange proponents used to look at their work as adversarial, they're really in conjunction to have the same outcome, to keep their community safe. And so what we've been able to do in North Carolina, for example, is provide some sort of training for law enforcement to help them reduce their attitudes and negative associations and behaviors with people who inject drugs, and provide a training for them around HIV prevention. Because as an occupational hazard, when a law enforcement officer is patting someone down on the streets, they're very likely to get stuck with a needle or a crack pipe or something that's going to be carrying a nasty disease that they don't want to get. So we can partner with law enforcement, for example, to let them know that they're at risk. Policymakers want to support law enforcement. They're going to be more likely to support law enforcement than they are to support the deviant category that Schneider and Ingram had talked about. And then also looking at other ways to build coalitions. So building coalitions with other people who need access to clean syringes, like people who have diabetes, for example, other HIV and AIDS organizations and groups as well. So that those are some ways that we can start to work towards more of a evidence-based policy approach for needle exchange programming. And in conclusion, I just want to say that morality, policy, and values will continue to play a really important role in finding solutions to social and health problems. Morality and value-based decisions are not going to go away, as rational as we'd like to think about these things, given our emphasis on evidence-based interventions. So what we need to do as professionals is to increase our policy analysis and understanding of the political process so we can see how to intervene and find windows of opportunities to either get our message across or build those bridges with unlikely partners. We can't use evidence alone to fight values, and I think that for too often in this fight, that's exactly what has happened. Morals and values and evidence are not speaking the same language, and so that's something that all sides need to understand. We do still continue to need to gather the evidence. We do still need to work on supporting our message with the best available evidence out there. But to use the evidence not just to inform the policy process with policymakers, but to use it as popular education to inform everyday citizens and consumers about these issues. And so if it's not going to be used in policy analysis, perhaps it can just be used to educate the community and citizens as well. And then as those of us who are part of research institutions or academic institutions, the responsibility we have in dissemination, which I don't think that we've given enough credence to in our past training. So that is morality and evidence-based policy in a nutshell using needle exchange programming. Here are the resources, and if you have any questions that you don't want to ask today, you're welcome to email me and contact me. Thank you.